The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Man in America. I'm your host, Seth Holhouse. As we stand in history at this moment, for those of us that are aware, we look at the world right now and see a series of battlefields. We understand that America is at war, not just with a singular country like China or Russia, but with an entity, with this grouping of evil people. Call them whatever you want to, the cabal, the deep state, the Illuminati, there's all kinds of names, but fundamentally, it's this group of people that are sometimes coordinating, sometimes going against each other, but fundamentally, they all want to collapse America because America represents freedom. America represents people ruled by God, people that have rights given to us by God, and a government that is forced to support that, as by our Constitution. And this is why America is such a threat to all of these countries and groups and secret societies around the world, because it is that example. And so joining us today is Matt Arrett, someone who I've had on before, who is brilliant and very well researched and someone that I really enjoy speaking with, because we can get into the very deep and kind of philosophical discussions about where we're at in history. And so today we're going to be talking about the founding of America and how the founding fathers that really set forth the foundation for this country that we now live in, they set this example to us. They gave us this example. They understood the war against the cabal, against the deep state, because they were also fighting that war. And we're going to be looking at the role that the founding of America has had in this global 1,000-plus-year-long war against these evil bloodlines and entities and everything. So this is going to be a much more philosophical discussion. So if you're not into those kinds of talks, maybe you should tune to the next show. But if you like diving into history and diving into the philosophy and understanding the origins of what we're up against, you're going to find this an absolutely fascinating show. So folks, please enjoy this interview with my good friend, Matt Arrett. Matt, it was such a fascinating conversation the first time having you on here, and I am very excited for this next evolution of our discussion. So now that you've got your espresso finished, we can dive right in. Thank you again so much for being here. It's just nice to have you on the show.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be with you. Looking forward to a brief but probably very dense set of ideas that we'll unpack today.
Yeah, and that was the conclusion I came to after our first interview, was that we're going to have just multiple parts. This is part one, two, three, four, five, you know, whatever, because you're a guy that like doesn't just go deep. You're going like Mariana Trench, like to the bottom of the ocean deep in a lot of these topics, which is great because that's where I get excited and have fun. So let's go ahead and just dive in. So what is your main focus right now? Last time we were on, we talked a lot about the hidden controllers behind the world. We talked about some of the secret occults, the various kind of hidden religions and practices, and how these families and these bloodlines are still manipulating our world. But let's go ahead and dive in with where you're at right now.
Sure. Yeah. Getting at the causal roots of global history is so valuable, and it's not. Because there's a lot of these like smaller narratives that explain little things, localized things that are, 9/11 was an inside job. What were the three triangulated shooters that killed JFK? What was the Federal Reserve actually, So you've got these micro narratives that satisfy the curious mind that thinks outside the box, but they don't really satisfy the deeper question of how all of these things are connected. How is the JFK murder tied to the exact same process that generated the inside job of 9/11, or the whole plandemic thing that was more recent, or the Federal Reserve thing much earlier, even though the people who executed those operations have long been dead, and are separated by big spans of time, there's a continuous process. And it's that continuous process, which is also tied, if you, the more you dig, to the battles of the founding fathers, right? Against the world's greatest globally expanded empire, which was not just a bunch of guys wearing red funny coats and funny hats, that was able to sort of dominate 25% of the world's surface area from a little island called the British Empire. It was that, that doesn't, you can't do that with just brute force or just a British East India Company. You need to have an interconnected network of finance, of the control of banking. That's the City of London, right? We talked about that last time. But also you need to be able to have a certain sensitivity to social engineering, how the mind of the people and how cultural dynamics work such that you can manipulate whole cultures to undermine their own goodness and work against each other and work against their neighbors so that they're so busy fighting themselves internally or with their neighbors that they can't work together to do anything about the great overlords that see themselves as these superhuman gods of Olympus, not subjected to the moral laws of the lower slaves. Like, morality is fine and ethics is fine, but only for the lower uninitiated slaves. For the higher initiated Ubermenschen, that's a different, we have a different rules. We make our own rules because we are gods. So you have this whole like mythos as part, but it's not more than a mythos. It's an organizing principle of oligarchical systems into the ancient times.
I'll make a quick point with that is just that,
yeah,
you know, when we look back at our founding fathers, I think it's very easy to simplify what was happening at that time and think mm-hmm. that, okay, these were these people that wanted the freedom to practice, you know, their version of Christianity or to practice other religions freely. They were tired of being oppressed by the crown. So they sailed to America and started a new country. And then they, they cast off at a certain point, they rejected the British crown. So we're going to rule ourselves because God's given us these rights. And what's interesting though, in this hearing you explain what you did so far and thinking about it is that the founding fathers, right, you know, back in the 1700s, they were fighting the same cabal of evil that we're fighting today. It's almost like because a lot of us became aware of this cabal recently in the past, say, 5, 10, 15 years, that we might think of them as just more current. But this the same entity in its earlier forms was also the one that did not want America to exist, that wanted to overthrow America, that they were actually fighting against. It wasn't just the British crown and we don't like taxation without representation. It was so much deeper than that. It's almost like, say, 200 years from now, looking back and saying, well, Donald Trump was up against the, he was fighting the left. He was fighting the Democrats that were corrupt. Like, it's like, no, that's so oversimplifying the depth of what's going on, the depth of the battle. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there because it's fascinating to think about them at that time, the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, and how that was separating themselves from this satanic cabal. It's just interesting to look back like that.
Yeah, it makes it come alive more, right? Like, it makes history alive and it makes us realize that we are living in history. And that's something that the mind often plays tricks on itself to sever itself artificially from the process that we, the context, right? That we are living in, and people will be looking back and judging us who aren't even born yet and studying these moments and trying to make sense of it. And so it's a different way to sort of see the drama as a more living thing and not just an academic exercise of memorizing trivial facts on a timeline. It's more real. But yeah, like the Hellfire Club, right? Like what the heck was the Hellfire Club? It was all of the governing elites of the British High Command were all members in the 1740s, 1750s, even earlier, of the British Hellfire Club. Now, this is what was understood by Cotton Mather, John Winthrop Jr., the people who had recruited a young Benjamin Franklin when Ben Franklin was like delivering candles that his dad was making to the different people in his town. And Cotton Mather was like a major purchaser of these candles. And this, you know, Ben Franklin talks about how he discovered Cotton Mather's library, and Cotton Mather recruited this young guy who had so much talent into the higher cause that had already been going on before Ben Franklin's birth in 1704. And there had already been, from the founding of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, an effort to create a city on a hill, like a new type of society founded upon the inalienable rights of all humankind, instead of having hereditary elites govern over us as sort of these superhumans. And if you think about it, like there's a famous story of John Winthrop Jr. at 89 years old getting out of bed and, you know, and condemning Ben Franklin's older brother, who was setting up a chapter of the Hellfire Club in Philadelphia, and calling him out. And there was like 11 different chapters in the colonies being set up. Now, the Hellfire Club itself was a satanic mystery cult that was as one of the leading, because you had two key guys, Sir Francis Dashwood, who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer of Britain. Like that's the top, that's like the top dog as far as banking or banking policy. It's the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Francis Dashwood was the head of the Hellfire Club and set up. He purchased a. I go through this in my newest essay that I just published on my Substack today, which is why it's front and center in my mind. But oh yeah, that's the one right there. Yeah, the ancient occult roots of the Fabian Society, Cybele, and the mysteries of Eleusis. Yeah.
Hey folks, I've got a quick message for you. So I'm sure you've heard a lot of people, myself included, talking about the importance of buying precious metals, gold and silver. But what's really behind that? Is just a thing of, hey, buy this gold, buy this silver, right? Or is there something deeper that we should be looking at? So I recently came across some figures about house prices. So in 1930, the average family home was approximately $4,000. Fast forward to 2023, the average family home is just over $400,000. So you have to ask yourself, why is that? Is it because things have just gotten more expensive? No, it's actually because the dollar has lost 99% of its value since 1930, right? When people talk about the collapse of the dollar or inflation, this is what it means. Now, let's take a look at gold. So in 1930, if you wanted to purchase your home in gold, it would take approximately 200 gold coins. So 200 gold coins would purchase the average family home in 1930, about $4,000. Now, if you, instead of buying a home with that gold or cash, you set those aside, if you set aside $4,000 in cash in 1930, it would be worth $4,000 today. What can you buy with $4,000? Can you buy a family home? No, you can't even buy a crappy used car. But if you set aside $4,000 worth of gold coins in 1930, which is 200 gold coins, 1 ounce coins, that would be worth approximately $400,000 today. And this is the key lesson about precious metals. It's not about getting rich. It's about putting your money into an asset that protects you against inflation and against the destruction of the currency, which is what happens to all fiat currencies, especially now we're in the end days of the dollar. And so that's why it's important, maybe not all of your money, but a portion of your money, a portion of what you have, I highly recommend putting it into precious metals of gold and silver, because what it's doing is it's protecting you. This is an asset that has stood the test of time, not just stood the test of time since the 1930s. We're talking about the rise and fall of civilizations. Gold was used to buy houses back in ancient Rome. It's still around. It's an asset that will forever have its value. So folks, if you want to do this and you need someone you can trust, there's no person I can recommend more than Dr. Kirk Elliott. He's a very good friend of mine. He's a strong Christian patriot, and he's out to really help people to protect their savings and what you've worked for against the destruction of the dollar, not to mention also protecting it against the dangers of a central bank digital currencies. So to learn more about this, go to goldwithseth.com or call 720-605-3900. Again, that's goldwithseth.com or 720-605-3900. Both those places will allow you to set up a quick appointment where you can talk to a wealth advisor that will help get you started on this path. Again, goldwithseth.com, 720-605-3900.
Part of what was going on in the caverns underneath this Medmenham chapel that he purchased, which was a former Benedictine monastery that he revamped into some Gothic satanic cathedral with a little banner saying, "Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law." That's the banner that you still see to this very day, but in French, of what you walk through when you go into the underground caverns. And all of the British high command were members of the Hellfire Club. That was sort of the mother cult of these junior branches that were set up in various parts of the British Empire to indoctrinate and corrupt local elites to be local managers and stewards of this global system. It's not that different from the sorts of things that we see today with the Roundtable Movement, for example, which was part of my current series, is that the Roundtable Movement and the Fabian Society were two, you could call them think tanks, but really what they were doing was reviving the the ancient mystery cults of Mithras and Cybele. Cybele being also known in the ancient Greek as the, or in Greece, the variation of Cybele was the goddess Demeter, the harvest goddess. That's the goddess at the heart of the Eleusinian mysteries. That was an initiation process that involved a lot of hallucinogenic drugs. It involved like wheat blight, the thing that Albert Hofmann used to extract LSD-25 in 1942. He was studying the Eleusinian mysteries and looking at the different types of fungus that grows on wheat, and extracted a molecule, lysergic acid, which gives you a crazy hallucinogenic trip, apparently. And that became at the heart of the whole MK Ultra, you know, social engineering experiment to mass initiate a whole generation of people that had formerly been reserved for the inner elite. So you had a variety of these ancient sort of hallucinogenics as part of the depatterning and reconstruction of identities around something more conducive to oligarchical systems in the ancient times. That was part of what the cult of Cybele brought into Rome during the Second Punic War against Hannibal. And that's part of why I'm also saying that when you look at the Fabian Society, they took their name from Fabius Maximus, the oligarch who was made a tyrant who fought against Hannibal during the Punic War. And use a certain technique known as the technique of attrition to wear out your enemy by avoiding direct combat. So that's what the Fabian Society has sort of become known for in the 20th century, is sort of just slow infiltration and avoidance, right? With a long-term patient perspective of gradualism and penetration of everything. But that's only half the truth. The other half that people often ignore is that Fabian, because the name Fabian Society comes from that general, right? And it worked quite well. But the other half is that that general was also overseeing the bringing into Rome of the cult of Cybele as part of a prophecy that was given by a Sibylline oracle, saying that only if you bring in the cult of Cybele from, which is a Phrygian cult, that you will be successful in your victory against Carthage. And so Emperor Fabius Maximus was the guy who was brokering that deal. It took years to make it finally happen. And that's what set into motion one of the quickest plunges into corruption and moral decay in Rome's history, was the bringing in of this mystery cult as well. So why am I saying this in the context of the Hellfire Club? Because Sir Francis Dashwood had a lieutenant by the name of John Wilkes. And the name might sound familiar, but he was a British journalist of the 1740s, 1750s. He was actually became a member of parliament in the 1780s. And he's actually the guy who put down the 1780 Gordon Raids, which was this proto-Jacobin anarchistic effort in Britain to capture some of that revolutionary fervor that had spread from the American colonies, you know, where a lot of people in Europe were thinking, well, hey, if they can fight, these backward colonists can fight for their liberties, why can't we also claim our liberties too? So that was a contagious idea. It didn't just go straight to France. It was in Germany and Spain and Russia and Poland and in England itself. And so the people had a lot of like desire to go back to the republicanism of the 1640s, right? Because Britain was the world's first republic. And it only lasted for 10 years. They cut off their king's head and it didn't work. It was a disastrous mess of black occult operations that undermined a lot of good. And the thing kind of just fizzled out, and you had the restoration of the monarchies with Hobbes after that. But all that to say, John Wilkes was assigned to put down this artificial sort of color revolution called the Gordon Revolts, led by another member of parliament, Sir something, George Gordon or something, who ends up getting put down. He goes into exile, becomes the advisor to Marie Antoinette, and also becomes a leading Kabbalist. He renounces Christianity, becomes a Kabbalist rabbi. It's weird. But this guy, John Wilkes, who puts down the raids and restores order, he was a high-level lieutenant of Sir Francis Dashwood of the Hellfire Club that Ben Franklin infiltrated to get intelligence back to Cotton Mather and the leading patriots in America. That's part of what this young 22-year-old was sent to do in London, is get intel. And that's why people say, oh, Ben Franklin, he was a Hellfire Club Satanist. The whole American Revolution was a fraud. That's a popular thing that floats around, because they make that connection and they don't see that. No, counterintelligence isn't just a new thing. This has been going. Good people and bad people do counterintelligence in real world history. So anyway, John Wilkes, at the time, he gave an interview describing what were these weird things going on in the underground caverns, which, by the way, under this Benedictine monastery, these caverns had already existed even before the Benedictine order was created in the 6th century. These caverns already were there because they're Mithraeum. These are the ritual places where the worship of Mithras, which was a Persian god brought into India, then brought into Rome via the Assyrian sort of zone. It was brought in to Rome that worked very closely with the cult of Cybele. So everywhere the cult of Cybele goes, you have the cult of Mithras. They always work together. And they always work in Mithras cases, men only. That's why it's also the model used by the round table of Cecil Rhodes, Milner later on was the revival of the Mithras cult. The Crusaders, the Templars were also, in my assessment, were a Mithraic Gnostic cult, pseudo-Christian that oversaw the Crusades. But the Benedictines were also created. I'm throwing a lot of information at people. I'm sorry. People might have to press stop, pause, think about it, breathe a little bit. I'm so sorry, but I know we have a limited amount of time, so I'm saying this quickly. but the Mithraeum were, and they've discovered hundreds of these Mithraeum all over Europe, Britain, even into Russia. In there's Mithraeum everywhere that they've discovered, and it's interesting. It's weird. It's a picture of a guy killing a bull. That's Mithras. Bull represents something really strange. And so anyway, John Wilkes gives testimony saying, we're actually practicing the mysteries of Eleusis. And he openly describes what I don't know why he was allowed to say this, but he chose to say it, that the mysteries of Eleusis were what they were doing in the underground caverns. The mysteries of Eleusis, again, are tied to the cult of Cybele, as I mentioned, because they're the mysteries that were brought into Greece and then Rome, that were tied to the harvest goddess. And there's this whole idea of going into the underworld. There's a whole story associated with her male counterpart, Attis, who there's a sort of mythology which involves Attis being her sort of son, husband, brother, lover thing. It's a weird Freudian thing. As the mythology goes, fell in love with a human. She got angry, scared the hell out of Attis, her consort, who becomes he basically goes crazy, cuts his manhood off, bleeds out, dies. She basically begs Zeus in grievance to revive him. He can't do it fully, but he can at least revive him in a form, making him the god of vegetation that comes back to life every year. His cult is worshipped before Christianity as by giving gifts to a pine tree. that representing the tree that grows out of the stump of another tree, sort of being emblemic of Attis. But to be a priest, a hierophant of the cult of Cybele, you have to, as a man, cut off your manhood too. And they kind of did this through a ritualized frenzy, helped with some hallucinogenic drugs that would then make you sort of pure. You'd also have different techniques of whipping yourself too. That becomes part of what the Benedictines later on innovate or revamp for the Christian veneer with the ropes they carry around their satchels around the robes they whip themselves when they have a bad thought. The Franciscans end up doing this too. The Jesuits do this too. So you got this whole continuity of different synthetic Christian orders that are reviving the Gnostic Gospels that were pre-Nicene Gnostic texts, the Book of Seth, the Book of Mary Magdalene, the Book of Thomas. There's a whole variety of them that were recovered in Egypt, but they already had a bunch that were known for thousands of years that had been maintained in sort of secrecy underground, shaping the different occult movements from the Templars through the Rosicrucians. The Franciscans as well had a sort of inner teaching and what's called the esoteric doctrines versus the exoteric public doctrines. So you always have this technique in these different pseudo religious orders that act Jewish or they act Christian, but they're not, because they're actually carrying on the secret gospels of what Jesus secretly told his lover Mary Magdalene, right? And who then told the two of the 12 select elite disciples that then carried on the secret gospel and teaching that the masses were not wise enough to understand. That's the Kabbalah.
They believe there's this secret stuff that was given via that, right? That like Jesus you whispered these secrets into Mary's ears, and that they've got this more enlightened version of things, which gives them some sort of power and some sort of control over the ordinary people, right? Some sort of elitism that kind of stems from that.
Immediately the elitism naturally sets in as soon as you into that mode. Of course, yeah, because it's beyond reason. It's not like it's a type of knowledge that cannot be taught through the activation of reason, which all human beings are born with. You can't do it. It has to be a felt set of experiences that you go through associated with certain symbolic patterns you are given that are infused with meaning by a higher priesthood that tells you what the meaning is. That means it's beyond reason. But because it's beyond reason and thus cannot be taught, but is still somehow knowledge, you have to become an elitist. Like, you have to think and kind of look down on everybody who's too stupid to know what you know, because you've gone through the rites of initiation.
And so basically it's like piecing this all together, which is really helpful, because I think that the same way that I said earlier on that we look back at the founding fathers, we look back at the founding of our country, and we oversimplify things. And I think a lot of us oversimplified things up until recently, when you go through this process of realizing, wow, things are way more complicated than I realized. And what I'm gathering from this, in addition to my own revelations and understandings that I've had, is that like what we're up against, that what's going on in this world is, there's just the average person that's a good person, you know, to a certain degree. They're trying their best just to, you know, live their life, protect their family, prosper, just live a life, right, as a human being, and figure things out in this very deluded world that's really, really confusing. But that there's also this web of secret societies, secret religions, hidden information, these cults, these groups, such as you mentioned, Hellfire. We've heard so many other different names, the different groups and cults that have been kind of woven throughout history, and they're passing down these teachings. And maybe we have these small interactions with them. Like, I remember coming across this book on glands that was originally part of the Rosicrucians. Right, it was a really fascinating book that my wife introduced me a while back, and like, oh, it's very, very interesting. You don't find this anywhere in modern medical texts. So that. Basically, we're here in 2024 now, up against this enemy that we perceive as the cabal, the deep state, whatever we want to call them. But it's this almost multi-thousand year old creature that has many heads and has many lives and has many arms, and it's been slowly morphing throughout history with this end goal of consuming the entire world. And I believe that Satan is at the crest of this, or whatever you want to call that. But this is the complexity of what we're up against. And it's a similar entity that the founding fathers were up against, that they were fighting against. It's evil incarnate, but this evil manifests in this world through these dark black magic practices and through this sacrifice. And you know, everyone's very focused on Epstein right now and Epstein Island. And it's about, wow, is this person's name that was on the list, is he a pedophile? And that's where the discussion ends, without actually thinking beyond that to, what role did Epstein Island play in worship and sacrifice and ritualistic abuse in like all of these secret societies? I mean, it's almost, it's so much. I can tell that you've spent a large portion of your life digging into these things, but it's so much just to even start to grasp these concepts and think, oh my gosh, like this is something very big, but it's also something very simple that we're up against.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it. And it's daunting at first if you haven't like ventured into exploring these trails. It's like the proposition of going there is a daunting, scary thing if you don't have the reference points, but you have to have a little bit of, like, you have to have had some limited kind of discovery. And I think everybody watching your show has made some degrees of discoveries about the big narratives being bunk in varying ways. And that's fun. That's great. Now you got something to work with because you've made little discoveries. These are now your reference points, not some authority in a textbook or some mass opinion of some, you know, group dynamic. that is going to like replace your act of thinking for yourself. You got your own act of thinking for yourself. You know what the discovery felt like. And so you could always reference that back to that. You can hold on to that. And when you're going into the unknown and you're sort of like leaning into it, but with patience, with not forming prejudgments, because, you know, we don't know what we don't know. Like we're kind of going into something that is new, but like you have to sort of withhold the act of premature judgment so that you can get as much of the material, much of the different hypotheses about what you're looking at as possible in your mind at the same time, at which point you start scrutinizing each of the different hypotheses, generate your own hypotheses, and come up with something that satisfies as best as possible a resolution to the various dissonances or paradoxes that emerge. Because undoubtedly, if you're taking false hypotheses into the unknown, it won't work. There's going to be all sorts of cracks called paradoxes, things that are self-contradictory. So you want to reduce those as possible by generating a hypothesis, selecting a hypothesis from within your own mind that will resolve as many as possible. There will always be some, we'll never know everything. So will always be a degree of unknown, but you can create potent hypotheses that work, that help you trailblaze even further. But you have to have the faith to go there.
Folks, I have a quick message for you. Look, the 2024 election is do or die for the globalists and communists that have infiltrated our country and are currently running it. And they either have to win or they're going to destroy America so nothing is left either way. And if you're the person that's watching this show and following this information, unfortunately, you have the weight on your shoulders of making sure that your family is prepared, especially as we head into this next year and this next election cycle, because unfortunately, I think it's going to get rough. And one of the ways I know they're going to target us is through our food supply. You can see all the food factories burned down. You can see the warnings of coming famines and food shortages and everything like that. And food is one of the number one ways totalitarian regimes have always used to control the populations, destroy the food supply. So if you don't have at least 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 months worth of stored food, I highly recommend you take that very seriously. Because look, as I mentioned, if you're the person that's watching this, you're the person that carries the burden of making sure your family is prepared. I would recommend at least 6 months, if not a year, of storable food. So if things go haywire, whether it's grid down or terrorist attack from what's coming across the border, that your family can safely stay in place and you can feed your family. So folks, today, go to heavensharvest.com and make sure you get your storable food that'll last for up to 25 years. Just in case things go south, you know that you have what's going to take to feed your family, which is so, so critical for us to get through this next stage of history. So go to heavensharvest.com today, order your food that lasts up to 25 years, and use promo code Seth to save 15% on your entire order. Again, that's heavensharvest.com and use promo code Seth, S-E-T-H, to save 15% on your entire order. Yeah, just interesting hearing, because just reflecting on my own journey, because like for me, it takes a lot for me to form a rigid view on something. Like there's very few things that I hold in my mind that are absolute. And that's how I venture into this unknown. I have my guideposts though. Like I know that God is real. I know that heaven and hell are real. And not just because I was told that, it's because I've had my own experiences in my life that I've experienced my own kind of piercing into the veil of that and using faith to get through very difficult things and understanding so much beyond that. But so it's like, I know that Satan is real. I know that we're in a battle of good versus evil. I know that communism is evil. I know that communism is a tool of the elites to overtake countries, to brainwash the masses, to bring in a very evil and immoral way of life, which then kind of leads things to very even darker places, right? So there's certain things that I've come to this conclusion through my own research, my understanding that, okay, this is a concrete idea. And it's like, if a guest was on here and they said, actually, you know what? Communism is a really good thing. And here's why. I'm going to have these alerts going off. Like, okay, that doesn't align with my, like there's a paradox there that is not correct. And so I can't go there. But I also understand that what we're up against is thousands of years of bloodlines. It goes deep into history to trace back this battle that we're fighting in right now, that we're just at the current phase of it. It's a battle that's thousands of years old. It's a battle for the soul of humanity. It's a battle for, you know, Satan trying to overtake God's creation of man. Like this is something I understand, but it's also helpful though in how you put that, because when I'm exploring new ideas, when the narrative changes and everyone's now, you're not everyone, but many people are saying now that, wow, Russia is good, Putin is good. Yeah, there's some experts in communism that say, no, actually the Soviet Union never fell. It was a feigned collapse, and there is still very communist, and they're working together with the CCP to bring down America. You start to have these dividing narratives where there's very differing opinions. And I go back to these foundational ideas I have of, okay, how do I navigate this? And how does this fit into the New World Order and the bloodlines? And so just interesting hearing you as I'm piecing it. It's almost the concept of this, even this discussion itself, is such a heady conceptual process of how do we slowly kind of, we're in this dark cave trying to map out the geography of the cave and work our way out of it. So how do we know that we've found a real ground and a real pathway that actually leads somewhere, not into some other illusion or into more darkness? And it's not easy. I mean, this is the human condition. It's not easy.
Dude. Yeah, no, absolutely. It's part of the journey of discovery. And I mean, it's a privilege just to be on the journey, right? Cause a lot of people are deprived of the opportunity to step onto this path of self discovery. And it really is a discovery of self while we're discovering what's before us and outside of us. We're also going inward, self examining our feelings, our assumptions, our core axioms all the time, and always revisiting, new hypothesizing. So there's always this back and forth with the universe and God's creation, right? As we're going inward and outward at the same time, which I think is what the oligarchy has sort of refined techniques of disturbing that. Like babies do that naturally. They're always like modeling, right? They're trying to express all of this feeling they have in them, but they don't have the tools to do it. So they're modeling themselves off of what it appears the sovereign big things are doing and saying and speaking and sounding like. And so it's a natural ego-free thing that's done by children. They're playing with each other independent of their skin color or whatever. They're just playing these natural human impulses. And sure, they're being annoying when they're in their twos and stuff. But despite all of that, there's this purity and goodness that I think shows us what is the fundamental property of being human first and foremost. And then you can start sort of take it a step back, because the oligarchy will utilize techniques that convince us that there is subjective selves that are tied to the pollution of feelings and stuff. And then there's the truth, objective truths outside of us that are raw, feeling free, pure logic. And by creating this divide, also it affects the arts, right? How we think of the arts as being something separate from reason. So you have, like, you know, Mark Rothko, Jackson Pollock, all sorts of like just paint splatterings of postmodernity in the arts and abstraction, or atonalism in music that's designed to be disharmonious and irrational, and not connected in any way to reason. Whereas the sciences, we're also told, are not supposed to be beautiful. It's just about the raw facts, Darwinian assumptions of the struggle of the strong against the weak in a world of diminishing returns. And it's unfortunate that that's the way, you know, the universe is wired, but that's why empire is legitimate, because it's the strong just being natural against the weak. It's science. And thus transhumanism comes out of that very easily, eugenics earlier. So you can just see how all this stuff is what, again, the founding fathers, Ben Franklin, when you read his writings on the observations concerning the increase of mankind, he's directly refuting Malthus before there was Malthus. He's demonstrating why it's a blessing to have more people. If you do things that are tied to a dignity, if you pass laws, economic and political, that are tied to the assumption that there is a dignity and a power of creativity in the people that generate resources, it's a good thing to have more people. It's only when you lose that sensibility that all of a sudden people become a problem, because there's only so many resources to go around and things are going to get fewer and fewer in number as you have more eaters. That then requires the elites to think about new ways of, you know, using disease or famine or war to cull the human herd, which is what Malthus literally says in his Essays on Population in 1799. It's disgusting, but it's a logical outgrowth of the division of the subjective from the objective, right? Completely. And so in Ben Franklin, he's such a wonderful character to get into his mind, read his books, his autobiography, look at his scientific discoveries too, because his work in science in the 1750s and his discovery of something that none of the great, you know, minds of Europe, none of the great academics were able to discover what he discovered as somebody from the, you know, grade three education or less in the outskirts of empire living with, like, you know, in the minds of the Europeans, he was like a dirty kid living with bears. Where, you know, and but he was able to discover the nature of electricity, this electric fluid from the sky that formerly would cause great damage during thunderstorms, forest fires, village, everything. And then by discovering the nature of electricity, creating a language around how it communicates, how we can understand it, all of a sudden there were things like lightning rods. You could communicate messaging via the use of electricity. You had a power. The universe, it's like the universe itself resonated with our obedience to the discovered law of that universe. That was then, Ben Franklin didn't want this to be for an inner elite, but really worked hard to popularize it, create games for kids, for people. And he charmed not just the people who became culturally upshifted within the colonies by the making this fun, you know, these different experiments with electricity, but also gave us a greater power over nature, over God's creation as stewards of creation, by now being able to support more of our people with a higher quality of life, by also incentivizing new inventions and discoveries so that people could, like, make money off of having a good idea that worked. Like, that was part of the revolution, but also the much of the aristocracy of Europe too was super charmed by this guy. He was like, he could tell stories. He was able to, like, win over people who had access to their humanity, even if they were born into aristocratic bloodlines. There was like a power to this ability to just be fundamentally human, and that's how he was able to win over a big chunk of the French leadership. Like, Marquis de Lafayette wasn't alone, and people around the king of France, who got his head cut off later on, Louis XVI, he supported massively. He put the French treasuries into supporting the Americans in their fight. He won over leadership of the Muslim world, of Sidi Muhammad, the emperor of Morocco, who gave protection to the American ships against British directed Barbary pirates. He had Hyder Ali and Tipu Sultan, the Muslim Indian leaders who were rebelling against the British Empire in 1780, also writing letters to the Continental Congress saying, your fight is our fight, we're in this together. You know, he had the Tsarina Catherine the Great and her sister Ekaterina Dashkova, who was the president of the Russian Academy of Sciences, who made Ben Franklin the first American member of the Russian Academy. And Dashkova became the first Russian member of the Philosophical Society of America. And she was the one who initiated the League of Armed Neutrality that ensured that there would be supplies maintained to support the American colonists in their fight. So it was an international conspiracy. You could call it that. It's not, conspiracies are not always just a bad thing. But it was when many, many people work together for a common cause, and it often has to be done in secret because you're doing battle with powerful Satanists who have a lot of power to undermine the good.
One question that really comes out of this for me in this discussion and looking at America is, so as we've established that there's this ruling elite that, you know, they're tied into satanic rituals and the dark arts and secret societies, etc. And they've been, you know, kind of pining for global control for a very long time. So when America was founded, right? Because I'd imagine that before America came into the picture, that while things were very fragmented, there was a very, very concrete power structure in the world. And I imagine that a lot of countries that were maybe rejecting this power structure, that it was very difficult for them to do that, right? Because they had a king or a queen who could be bought off and controlled. And, you know, just the nature of how countries and governance worked at that time, it could be very easily conquered. It was very different than, I think, things today. So in the 1700s and with the founding of America, from your research and your perception, do you believe that at that time that the cabal, which we use that word to describe this group of evil people, do you believe that at that time they saw the threat that America would have in the future if it was allowed to grow and become this country that inspired rebellion and inspired casting off tyranny, and that wrote the laws of the heavens that these elites rejected into the founding of the country? So it's like, do you think that the founding of America was in certain ways the beginning of this final phase of battling for good versus evil on this earth, and that they knew that? Because I know that there's been a lot of different things they've done over the years, whether it's the Federal Reserve Act, there's different elements that the crown and the elites have done to keep America suppressed, but they haven't been able to really capture the American spirit and the lessons that we've been left from the founding fathers, which now at this time, right in history, we can see that we're drawing upon those lessons to give us wisdom and guidance in this fight, right? We're going back to 1776. We're using the example of the founding fathers, the sacrifice, the brilliance, the faith, the fortitude that they had to give us fuel and guidance in this final hour. So do you think that, I guess from your perspective, what is the role that America has played since its founding from the eyes of the elites? Has it just been this great worry for them that's been growing, and as it's grown, they're trying to control it? Or how do you frame that? How do you put that all together?
Yeah, no, I tend to think of St. Augustine. I'm if you had to ask me like about my philosophical sort of my personal philosophical foundations, I would say I'm a Augustinian Platonist. So, well, that's a kind of almost a contradiction in terms, since Augustine wrote in Platonic Dialogues, he was obviously a Platonist. But I'm not like, so the method of thinking of St. Augustine is sort of the closest to my heart. And I found it to be of the greatest use in making discoveries that are potent. Which is, again, it's a dialectic method governed by a sense of universals and a harmonization of reason and morality, of the conscience and the idea of moral law and scientific law coexisting in two sides of the same thing. So he wrote a book called The City of God in around 409, as the Western Roman Empire was collapsing. In The City of God, he outlines not just the sort of diagnostic of like why Rome is in this crisis of decay, corruption, and collapse going back 1,000 years before him. So he's doing a serious diagnostic of like the choices made at different moments that resulted in Rome losing what I guess an Asian ear would consider the mandate of heaven, the Tianmen, that there's God's law, the law of heaven, that should determine what is good for human laws to create. And if a human law is out of whack with said God law, then it is not a legitimate law, and the people have a mandate to overthrow that government or that emperor or whatever to create new laws. And that's what Mencius says in who's a follower of Confucius. Confucius is very similar to Socrates, as Mencius is very similar to Plato. That parallels this idea. But in the Christian worldview of an Augustine, it's the city of God as the laws of heaven that have to determine the what is a good law versus a false law created by fallible humans. But he also has this faith that ultimately human beings are mandated to become psycho-spiritually mature, such that we learn to love the good, love the natural laws of God, and work in harmony and obedience with those laws. And when we do that, oligarchism will no longer be able to sink its tentacles into us. But to the degree that we don't, and we maintain self-delusion, we'll always be ripe soil for manipulation and self-destruct, such that good people will end up working as instruments for their own destruction, as happened during the French Revolution, as happened during the Gordon riots of Britain. A lot of good people, I'd say like 95% of the people playing a role in those processes, were good people who just wanted a better way for their kids. They wanted a good life. They wanted to just live happy, but they wanted a better way. And they got into action, but not animated by sovereign. They weren't sovereign yet. So they got into action prematurely. They started following leaders like Lord Gordon himself, the Kabbalist later advisor to Marie Antoinette, who was like a hero of the people. You know, you read some of his speeches, they sound like he's exposing all of the evils of the city of London and all of the manipulation of the hereditary elite. He sounds great, but it's all a trap. It was always a trap to get the people to act prematurely. And you read Robespierre later on, or Danton and Marat, the leaders of the Jacobins, sounds like they're saying a lot of truth, calling out the corruption of the elites and the aristocracy. But what happens by people following their lead? They end up killing all of Ben Franklin's allies, the scientists, the leaders of the who helped make the American Revolution possible, got killed along with a bunch of bad people who were disposable. So the people, the mob, people lost their sovereignty. They became mobs and thus were playable like strings on an instrument to become like we see with Antifa kids. You know, it's like most of these kids playing a destructive role wake up in the morning. You know, they don't think of themselves. They could have been good kids. They could still in the future be good kids, you know, but they've been given a worldview that doesn't allow them to use their self-aware reasoning skills. They just can't do it. So they become easily mobified, or the color revolutions that have been honed by George Soros's open societies all over the world and the National Endowment for Democracy, which is a CIA front. They've honed these skills. They did that with the Bolsheviks earlier on, but they honed it again. They refined it. The Bolshevik Revolution was just a replication, but with more refinement of the French Revolution disaster that turned into a Jacobin bloodbath with everybody getting their heads cut off. And, you know, it resulted in a giant power vacuum that was calculated and that could then be filled by a proto-fascist like Napoleon, who was being funded by the same Rothschilds that he said he didn't like. Right. And then that created 20 years of forever wars that only could then be ended after a lot of pain, destruction of innocent lives and villages wiped out under the Napoleonic Wars by the 1815 Congress of Vienna, which was the restoration of the oligarchies, which basically said, okay, allowing ideas that were tied to freedom and things like we were stupid enough to do in the 1780s, that was stupid. That results in Napoleonic forever wars. Let's now restore the Jesuits from, because they had been illegalized in 1773. The Jesuits were banned from Europe. They had to go to Russia. So they were then creating the deep state structures of Russia. And then they were brought back in 1815 and allowed to reconstitute themselves to reestablish order and infiltrate. And also censors were set up in every school, every printing press. You weren't allowed to print forbidden thoughts. It was very Orwellian. That's where America benefited, because a lot of the freedom-loving Europeans, to avoid getting arrested or, you know, they lost their jobs as professors, they all went to America. So we had a huge influx of really great people, which I think in my analysis is the reason why America was able to survive those early precarious years, where Americans were also kind of being fed a lot of misinfo and garbage too. And we just had a lot of wisdom being brought in by exiled Germans who were saying, you don't realize how good you have it. Like, get your acts together, people. And, you know, we ended up voting for John Quincy Adams because of that.
It was like the, at a time when it was like needed. The good predecessor to the Operation Paperclip.
Yeah, exactly. That's a funny one. Yeah, exactly.
So, unfortunately, we're kind of running towards the end of our time window, yeah, which feels way too short. But I've got our interview scheduled, which I have to get to. So, in conclusion, when this is just kind of part one of this exploration together, but what I've gathered from this, actually, what I walk away with is this feeling of I want to learn more about history. I want to learn more about the history of the founding fathers. Read the writings of Ben Franklin. You go back and I've written down, you know, my notes, City of God, St. Augustine. I want to go read that. I want to understand better, because what I can see in this discussion is that there's nothing new. What we're seeing here in America, the battle that we're in right now, is it's a cyclical process, and it's happened before. You know, empires have risen and fallen, and understanding the principles of those and understanding the tactics and the techniques of those causing the collapse and the efforts of those resisting the collapse and understanding these things throughout history can be very beneficial in helping us understand what's happening now and what we can do. So with that, if I wanted to read a couple of books, 2 to 3 books, to better understand history, and I know this is a very broad question, but for someone saying, look, I'm just starting this process, what would you recommend?
Okay.
So there's one book here called How the Nation Was Won. I've found this to be super high value. If people could get it online, pay whatever you got to pay. If it's like $50, but I think you can get it for like $30 by H. Graham Lowry, How the Nation Was Won. He died before he could write volume two, but it's America's Untold Story, 1630 to 1754. Super high value, especially understanding the battles within Britain itself and the deep state of Britain. It really maps it out so beautifully. So that's a good scaffolding. Anything by Anton Chaykin, also super high value. Anton Chaykin's an EIR affiliated researcher, a good friend of mine. He's in his 80s, but he's done some incredible work. Who We Are, America's Fight for Universal Progress is his newest book. Volume one. He's writing volume two now. Also his Treason in America, 1984. It's a wonderful book mapping out America's deep state in a really great way. And I'll do a self plug for my own books. Clash of the Two Americas, volume 1 to 4. It's a 4-volume book series on this, again, the historic roots of this deep state, elaborating a lot, fleshing out what I just said in a quick form. And I would say the last thing might be for the understanding how to battle the occult arguments, because the occult has a certain sophistication behind it. The Rosicrucian texts of Francis Yates, which are full of lies, but she's a major figure within the occult intellectual underground. I wrote a book called the Science Unshackled to get across sort of the clash of the two sciences. One is a fake science, a doppelganger masquerading as science, the Newtonian Darwinian science that we're told is science. It's not really science. It's a fake science shaped by a bunch of wannabe magi and hermetic, you know, witches and shit. Then there's a real science that they're trying to undermine and obscure. Sorry, that was a bug flying in front of my, I wasn't doing a spell there. It was a bug. And so that, in my book, it's like 300 pages. It's on CanadianPatriot.org, Restoring Causality in a World of Chaos, gets across that. And I'll just end with, I guess, the last, because I know we're out of time. John Wilkes of the Hellfire Club is the grandfather of John Wilkes Booth. There's a direct connection there to the whole occult Kabbalistic underground that was tied to the British High Command and the Confederates around Albert Pike that created the Scottish Rite, or at least amplified the Scottish Rite to a new thing that also established the KKK, that was tied to the disposable idiot John Wilkes Booth, grandson of John Wilkes, Hellfire Club extraordinaire, Eleusinian mystery initiate. So that was just something I threw out. I wanted to just resolve that little dissonance.
What about Tragedy and Hope as a book?
It's useful, but I found it more useful because he wrote that when he was alive, Carol Quigley, and he said things in a way that would be more palatable in accepted academic crowds. With also his own, he himself wasn't against ultimately the New World Order that he was talking about. He just wanted it done a little bit differently. So there's going to be certain fallacious assumptions that he also embeds within his narrative. So there are Trojan horses. But I would say more valuable is his posthumously published Anglo-American establishment book, smaller book, easier to read in some ways, very fact heavy, but more direct and clear with the associations of the Roundtable movement and Coefficients Club and everything else, naming names and stuff. He says things that he wouldn't want to allow be heard when he was still alive. So more valuable, I would say, is that one.
Great. Well, Matt, it was a lot of fun. Next time I'll make sure I will book like a 2-hour window, because we can just keep going. We'll do it again. I'll have a lot of the links of things that we've talked about in the description below, your Substack, your Twitter. I encourage people to check you out, your website, which I brought up earlier, CanadianPatriot.org, where people can, this is everything about you. They can find the books, they can find your information there, links, a lot of your Substack stuff. Publish here directly as well. And just thank you for doing what you're doing. It's really fun having this conversation with you and just exploring these ideas, because to me, this is very interesting. And it's also, it's a nice change from just trying to figure out what's happening in DC or some of the very repetitive narratives. I feel like they actually go nowhere. So again, thank you for coming on, man. It's a pleasure speaking with you. And until next time, take care.
Look forward to it. Bye.
Folks, as you know, my friend Mike Lindell has a passion to help everyone get the best sleep of your life. And he didn't start just by simply creating the best pillow. He created the Giza Dream bed sheets. They look and feel great, which means an even better night's sleep for me, which is crucial for my busy schedule. Mike found the world's best cotton called Giza. It's ultra soft and breathable, but extremely durable. So Mike's Giza bed sheets come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a 10-year warranty. Giza Dream sheets come in a variety of sizes and colors. Mike's latest incredible deal is the sale of the year. So folks, for a limited time, you'll receive 50% off the Giza Dream sheets. You'll receive a set for as low as $29.98. So go to mypillow.com and click on the radio podcast square and use promo code MAN. That's M-A-N as in Man in America. There you'll find not only this amazing offer, but also deep discounts on all MyPillow products, including the MyPillow 2.0 mattress topper, MyPillow kitchen towel sets, and now even flannel sheets and so much more. So call 800-985-8966. Again, it's 800-985-8966. Use the promo code MAN. Go to mypillow.com. Make sure you use promo code MAN.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.